This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features Norm Lee, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong of the CSC. This interview was recorded in Vancouver on January 20th, 2019.
Okay, so Norm, you know, you're a self-taught cinematographer, mm-hmm. So I'd be curious, you know, how did you self-teach yourself? Did you have mentors or influences?
So I didn't actually have any mentors kind of growing up in my career. No formal mentors. I wish I did. I'm mainly self-taught through kind of just experimenting and just doing it basically and making lots of mistakes along the way.
Yeah, but how would you, like... And what was your first sort of maybe job as a DOP? How did you get that? Like, how did that come up?
Yeah, I did a Korean music video. This director came from Korea. And it was basically this really famous Korean band. But we were just walking around Vancouver filming them and shot on 16mm. This is many years ago. Yeah, somehow that video got quite a bit of traction in Korea. And I would see it kind of like, I was in Hong Kong and Korea. I just saw it on TVs everywhere. So anyways, that was a long time ago. And that's the first, I guess, job I got paid for as a cinematographer.
Oh, that's
maybe not very much, but I got something.
Okay, well, jumping ahead, mm-hmm. You know, from that from those early days, where did you sort of find yourself? I think you shoot commercials, but you do features.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start in commercials sort of first, like commercials branding? Because I know you've done some Red Bull stuff that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that probably led. So, you know, how do you feel, you know, what the genre of branding and commercials?
So it's interesting because for myself, I started off with more music videos and short films. And then I branched from short films to features. So commercials weren't really a thing for me for a while. I was kind of mainly, and then I kind of just stayed in long form features for the last, 12 years, I guess. But then I wanted, because I had a lack of short form experience, and this is something that's so prevalent now online, I wanted to experiment in that form. So lately, in the last 4 or 5 years, I've been doing a lot more short form in things that I kind of want people to see and to reflect who I am now as a filmmaker, to show like a certain aesthetic that I feel that I am currently in the stage of my life. But before, I've done lots of commercials before these last 4 years, but a lot of them were kind of things I would never want to show people.
Mm-hmm.
I've done hundreds of commercials, but none of them really reflect who I am. But I think to answer your question, my true interest lies in feature films that have social or controversial, maybe not so much political, or existential meanings. So that's what I'm more interested in right now. Is it allows me to kind of look in the mirror a little bit at myself and at life, and I like doing that and be able to share those kind of experiences with people in certain ways is very satisfying.
You like to do projects that do reflect a little bit about yourself.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I do. Whether they're fears or curiosities or, things that I'm just very curious about. But, I think it's very hard for me to now to do projects that I don't have any kind of resonance with.
No connection with.
No connection.
You need to have a connection.
I need to.
And I think because of the industry and how much work a DP gives to a project, you need to have that connectedness, or else then it's kind of empty. You can't give it that emotion in the lighting.
Exactly.
And the approach.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is, you know, obviously I love shooting and I love the process of it, but then I can't take on everything because there'll be too many things, and then I also won't be able to give it my all. So even sometimes when close friends ask me to see if I can do it, I need to now make sure that the project means something to me, or else it's not fair to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think someone else, if it's not if it's not right for me, for some reason, then I'm sure someone else that's very talented can
right.
can take on it. Yeah.
So it could maybe become potentially awkward, I guess, if it's
yeah.
a friend.
Yeah,
but I think
it can.
Being
yeah.
honest.
So right now it's interesting. I would rather take on a lot less projects, a lot less, to satisfy myself mm-hmm. emotionally.
Yeah, so to be fulfilling. I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, maybe not everyone operates like that, but I think on a mm-hmm. certain level, they kind of have to.
Exactly.
Whether you spin it to make it work. But I just remember looking at that one, for example, you were probably in a different point in your life, but, that Red Bull one you did out mm-hmm. east. I mean, that
yep.
was, were you into skateboarding or something? Or were you into, fun, extreme stuff?
No, so that project is interesting because for me, I've never done a skateboard film before. I haven't done any sports cinematography, but the director Alice Craig, who's very very talented, he wanted to bring on someone from a narrative background to do the film. So something he that I'm not just saying, but he actually said, I don't want just to have another skate film. I want someone that can just bring something else that maybe he's not aware of. I don't know if I did that, but it was very fun, and luckily I had three amazing cinematographers who were my camera operators, and they have lots of experience in skate cinematography, so they were able to skate around. I just sat on a control station operating the camera for some things, but...
Yeah, we always have to have multi-cameras on those kind mm-hmm. of things. But you did bring something, because I did watch that online, and mm-hmm. It wasn't just your typical skate mm-hmm. sort of branding thing. There was something. So I think he was right to go outside of his norm,
mm-hmm.
right? And get norm.
No. Yeah, no pun intended.
That's right.
Yeah.
So in general, though, when you approach a project, do you read the script first? And then, of course, you talk to the director. How do you sort of go in when you first get that script and... Where do you go from there? Is there a go-to
kind
of approach you have?
It's kind of changed over the years, but generally read the script. And before, I used to read it technically and story-wise at the same time. And I found that was really slow, and it was kind of meddling with the whole process. So eventually I started to just read it the first time as just a film and a story. And I felt like that helped me to inform some of the technical sides of the approach. So that's what I'm doing now more. I'm kind of reading it first, maybe once or twice, and then finally, now if I feel ready, I'll start to think about more, not so much where light should be or something like that, or what kind of lights I should use. It's more maybe the format of whether it's digital or film, generally film. and also, obviously, camera movement, a lot of the standard things, but I love... One of the best things is why something should be a certain way, and not just why that I should think it's a certain way. I can have my own perspective, and then the fun part is when you meet or discuss with the director or directors, what their perspective is, and sometimes it's completely obviously different, and that's okay, and it can be a bit not so much difficult, but because you kind of sometimes you really see it your way. You have to be really open to see others, because your own way is not the best way.
and they hire you for your perspective,
mm-hmm.
and it's the collaboration, and it's serving the narrative, of course.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times they want to hire you for a reason, so you they want your perspective, and it's interesting because a lot of times you try to cater to the director, especially if you don't know them at all, and you want them to be happy and to get what they want. But then what I've been kind of noticing is that well, what do you think, Norm? How come, not all the time, but sometimes you just really want them to be happy. And sometimes it's interesting because you might have all the same ideas. So they might think, well, how come don't you have anything else to say? No, this is what you're saying is exactly what I was thinking. So.
Then you guys are in sync. It's this is actually good. We're in sync.
Yeah.
We don't have to debate or wrestle.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So now story and then technical.
Now, is there... at this point, because how long you've been shooting for? How many years?
I guess professionally since 2003. 19 minus 16 years. Is that right? 19 months. Yeah, I guess so. Something like that.
Yeah.
16 to 17 years.
That's right.
Yeah, professionally.
So have you, established, is there something that you don't go to set without? Like, do you have some kind of little habit that, or even a piece of equipment that's something that is a secure thing because you know for sure what that's going to do? Or
now, you know, it's interesting. It's not so much equipment anymore, because as long as I request or I bring... If it's my own cameras or lenses, then I know I have what I need. But if it's, you know, in prep and you just request all the gear you need, you get that. For me, it's not so much the equipment anymore. It's actually this app for my iPad or my MacBook or even iPhone. They all share. It's called Shot Designer. And basically, it's overhead diagrams for lighting and camera and action blocking. So I've been religiously using that for the last 6 years. And for every single scene of a film or commercial or music video, just to get on the same page with every, not just the director, but the crew. And then they're like, oh, now, okay, I know where you want the dolly or that light or that crane or where's the actors. And then you can see just where everything is. So there was too many times in the past where, you know, we're on different pages, but we didn't realize it until the shooting day. And they say, oh, I thought you said this, or I thought that this and that. But now it's always... there that we have printouts of my diagrams. I have my physical diagram, which I can change on the fly. I don't have to stick to it, but it's a great baseline to work with. So I never go to set without that anymore.
Well, as they say, a picture is 1,000 words.
Yeah. Right. There was, I mean, just one example of this where I was shooting in this forest at night in the snow, and... there's a really large lighting setup, which I had to really convince producers and the production to let me have this 200-foot crane and this massive moon cube, which took 8 hours to set up before, and then cable up and everything in one exact area that we all agreed on. And then on the shoot day, and I love the director, but at the time, I think they wanted to explore different options in the area, and then they found something else they liked a little more. And it made it very difficult to change that lighting setup, because this is where we needed to do it. But in the end, we actually scrapped the entire setup and had to shoot in this other area and use a lot less of a broad, soft ambient source, and just use kind of some what we could do quickly and on the fly. So that was difficult. And
those things on the cutting room floor are... In this situation on set was left. Yeah, well, I'm sure there's probably many a story where you have the huge setup and all of a sudden something just went, oh.
Yeah.
And it was something, this is better.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Sorry.
You know, producers are like, you know, freaking out because of the money and stuff.
I know, yeah.
But it doesn't matter. It's for the story. So you own equipment, and seeing mm-hmm. that a lot of now is the time when people are owning their own equipment. And is what kind of decision or what led you to that?
Well, I've actually owned equipment for a very long time and gone through different stages of different equipment. So my first cameras were my very, very, very first camera a long time ago was like a Canon digital camera a long time ago. This is back even before 2002. But after that, I kind of got right into film. So I bought a 16mm camera, and then I bought a 35mm camera. So first I had an SR2, and then I got an SR3, and then I bought a 35-3, and then I bought a... I just kept going from there. And then finally, now I have the dream camera that I've always wanted, because since digital has been so prevalent, film cameras, the price has dropped, and I have three cameras that I now adore. So... it's I've gotten to, in terms of film cameras, that's more of my own thing to make sure I just have what I need. But for digital, I've had lots of digital cameras over the years as more of an investment in just for rentals, to be honest. So
even from the beginning, though, you own cameras, was it more to make let's say in film cameras, to make mm-hmm. sure you had your own and maintenance, you know, like making sure you had a pristine camera? As well as investment, did you rent out your film cameras?
No. So film cameras never rented out. It was just more so that I can enable to basically shoot film instead of digital as much as possible. And just, it's my own investment. So whether I had to bring it for free or whatever, it's just to help so I could, for smaller projects, I could just shoot with them. So yeah, there, I mean, obviously I've shot a lot of digital, but I just love film so much.
So the cameras you have, they have like an Alexa or something like that?
So yeah, I have multiple Alexas and I have lots of lenses of various kinds. But mm-hmm. right now for film cameras, Arri Cam LT, for Arri 416 and Arri 235.
Oh, you have those?
Yeah. So those are my favorite cameras. I've always never thought I would ever be able to own. And now, yeah. Yeah.
Now you have, can you say there was a film that helped sort of, whether it was your early days or just recently,
yep.
one that kind of helped, was a breakout film? Because some people kind of have mm-hmm. a breakout film.
Definitely.
Do you want
to? Yeah. I mean, in terms of like a breakout film, I have to thank the director Panos Cosmatos, who directed Beyond the Black Rainbow. That film really launched my career. So that was my second feature. Shot in 2008 or 9, I can't remember, to be honest. But it was the film that really pushed me and pushed the kind of the visual boundaries of what I was used to or what most people may have been used to at the time. And he really pushed me to experiment. So that was shot on the last Fuji stock ever until it went out of business with Fuji Eterna 400. And on Panavision cameras and 2 perf and Primos. So, or not Primos, sorry, it was Ultra Speeds. Anyways, for the people out there who want to hear that. So yeah, that film was just a game changer for me because after that, the ASC contacted me to interview for that film. And then also just many agencies were coming, producers, directors, everything. And now after all these years, I find out that it's still even more popular, actually, than it was before. And directors around the world are using it in their treatments everywhere. So it's been, referenced by major films or, you know, festival hits. Yeah. So, that it's something that I never, ever thought of. And because when I first read the script, you know, obviously I thought it was amazing. But what was different was, for example, in the script, there was like one of the characters, her name was Alina. It'd be like, Alina sits on bed, and then she gets off bed and walks to TV, and then like walks down hallway, and all these things that, but what was interesting is, it sounded really basic, I guess, in terms of some of the scenes, not all of them, but what really made the film unique was after I met the director and his approach to the film. All those moments were heightened by visual and sonic experiences. So it was he made it so unique that, you know, I almost don't know how I would shoot it now. I thought about that recently. Like, I don't know if I would do a good enough job anymore. I think I would probably do it slightly differently maybe, but at the same time I'm glad I did exactly the way I did mm-hmm. it back then.
Yeah, going in as that unknown, fresh.
Oh yeah.
And just
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. So yeah, that film really, really helped me so much and still does to this day. People still message and email me about this film and I'm still surprised.
Well, we're gonna have a rush now online. People are gonna wanna be watching it and searching it.
And his recent film called Mandy was released, shot by my friend Ben Loeb. And so yeah, that film now is really, you know, has gotten quite the momentum online.
Oh, that's great. The Never Steady, Never Still, I did see. And mm-hmm. I thought it was like, it was a beautiful film. It really was. And I know that it took a long time to shoot. You actually, mm-hmm. it was quite a process. Mm-hmm. And you were quite committed. And that's a big thing because you have continuity, but then you needed the seasons. And,
yeah.
you know, I'd love to hear, like, was it a large crew thing or was it a lot of natural light? Like, how did you shoot that?
So Never Steady, Never Still, for me, was, you know, even though, so Beyond the Black Rainbow originally was, again, shot in 2009, and that was my breakout film at the time. I was approached by a lot of films that were horror films after that, which, you know, I did some after, and I kind of didn't want to do any more after that. My main interest lies in drama. So my second breakout film, I would call it, Never Steady, Never Still, directed by Kathleen Hepburn, was probably also one of the most meaningful experiences I've had in my career. First of all, the film is loosely based on her mother who has Parkinson's disease, And it's just, yeah, it's just, there's so much truth and honesty and sincerity to the film. And it really reflected who she was, even our approach to the filmmaking. It's quite it's a very quiet film. And it's like, that's her personality too. It really reflects who she is. So that film, we shot over the course of 1 year because we wanted seasons changing, showing progression of time with, you know, winter, spring, and then finally we did a summer. And that film, yeah, so we shot that on 35mm, 2-perf as well, on Kodak and Fuji stock, old Fuji stock, which I use for interiors, and Kodak for exteriors. But in terms of like lighting, a lot of it was lit. It's supplementing existing light, and because we wanted it to look quite natural, and as if we didn't light it.
I mean, it did. It was naturalistic. I mean, it didn't even look lit.
Yeah.
But you could see everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was emotional, but you know that there's going to be something going on.
There's something there. Yeah. If there wasn't any, if I didn't do anything, then yeah, there'd be many parts that wouldn't be exposed properly. So I had to definitely augment what was there, or the feeling of the overcast, the feeling of you know, northern kind of Canada. There's a feeling to that that's quite cold, soft. So those are things I had to recreate.
I mean, did you use, I'm just thinking, you know, like that overcast West Coast look, and, you know, do you use negative fill to help give some contrast? Because it can be kind of flat.
Yeah, yeah. So I definitely, I mean, because depending if we shot interiors or exteriors, interiors, neg fill was basically enough from the interiors of houses or cabins themselves, or cars. But yeah, shooting outside, there was some neg fill, nothing crazy. It was just, again, shooting with the intention of where the sun was, and you know, so we didn't use very many bounces either. It was a lot of kind of one of my go-to techniques on set is called what I call a T-bounce. It's basically tabled 12 by 12 muslins outside of windows, so you don't see the frame or the stands, because the stands are on left and right of each window, and below the window is a light that's on the ground, whether it's, you know, 4K or 8K, 12, whatever it is, it will shoot directly up into this frame. And that bounce would create like a really soft ambience that doesn't flood the entire room, and has a very, very soft cut. So you're not trying to shape hard, direct lights coming through the window. It also kind of represents what kind of clouds are like. It's just this ambient, you know, you're going through cotton, and it's like it's this feeling of coming through that I don't need to shape too hard, and it doesn't feel artificial that way.
Yeah, and it's not strongly directional, it's just...
Yeah, very, very soft. Well, it was beautiful about that technique as well, because the film was very loose in its handheld camera operating. Wherever I would point, even out the windows, you never see the light or the stands.
Right, so you can look. This ambience coming in. That's brilliant.
Yeah. So this T bounce technique is something I've used a lot now in different sizes and forms, whether it's 20 bys, 12 bys, or 4 bys. It's something that I just love, this technique, because it just feels so natural. And sometimes I forget that there's a light out there, and then at lunch when they turn the lights off, it goes everything goes to the dark. Oh wow, this is not even real. I completely forgot. Like, what happened? Oh. So that's one of my go-to techniques in this film.
Mm-hmm. And you say handheld, so I imagine you probably operating the camera yourself.
Mm-hmm. So then most of the film was handheld for, you know, the reason of, I guess, emotionally, mm-hmm. just that felt intuitively correct, mm-hmm. and what the director and I wanted. But then we also, for landscapes, we wanted to keep it grounded and static. To contrast the emotion of what the families were going through by handheld. So the static stuff of landscapes and stuff like that was basically to show that nature and life is grounded and doesn't almost care about what's happening to the people around it. It's, you know, they are landscapes, and trees, water, sky, mountains are, they're independent of what human emotion activity. So mm-hmm. that was one of the reasons why to keep those static. Mm-hmm. And it really made, I mean, in our minds, we tried to make it feel like this young man and his mom and the father who died, and all these things all happened, and it just is a nice comparison, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, we see the earth and the trees are always steady, mm-hmm. whereas in yeah. on top, which never steady, humans. Never still. You
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
No, it was a beautiful film. I think more people should see it. You know. So, have you collaborated with this director before? Again?
Yeah. So Kathleen, who did Never Steady, Never Still, I just collaborated with her alongside another amazingly talented director, El Maya Tailfeathers. So they co-directed a film called The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. And it's an amazing film that deals with violence against indigenous women. It deals with oppression of First Nations communities and in society. And it's just a very powerful film. And it will be premiering in Berlin in this coming February. And in U.S. premiere will be Tribeca. So, yeah, that film was something I'm very, very proud of. And I can't wait for people to see. Because it's shot on 16mm anamorphic.
Oh.
And with Hawk anamorphic lenses. And there's only four scenes in the film. And the first three scenes are mini oneers. And then when these two women in the film meet by chance, the fourth scene is about 80 minutes. And it continues for 80 minutes in one single shot on film. So
how did you do that?
Yeah. 85 minutes in one single go. So without stopping the camera.
Is it film?
On film. So.
Oh, now this is really intriguing.
So it's, I believe, one of the first times this has been done in this format, in this way. There's been a lot of single takes in films that kind of, well, there's more and more single take movies. One shot for the whole movie, but shot digitally, of course. Yeah. Now, this film, the directors wanted the actors to experience from start to finish in that scene, emotionally, one kind of, you know, experience. So it wasn't, originally they wanted to shoot digital just to make it, like, how do we, there's no other way, that's what they thought. They're like, well, you know what, we need to continue this is such a film that needs to be shot on film. It's all about downtown and east side and Vancouver east side, and like the people and the locations and the weather, everything's so interesting and so I really wanted to push the shoot on film on this one. They said, well, how do we do it? So I said, give me some time. And I came back and I proposed a way that allowed us to just continuously shoot for 85 minutes without stopping the actors. And this was using three cameras with 13 preloaded magazines of film. And there was 12 designated transition points, which we would pass by, and every time we pass, like, say, transition point number one, I would hand the camera off in real time to a grip while another one is pre-rolling and handed to me in real time, so that there's only...
In the same flow.
In the same flow. Flow and same frame, flow.
So that you can make a very...
smooth, slow transition. And so basically, the transition point was, you know, seamless, and it didn't interrupt the actors. But behind the camera, there was a whole lot of stuff going on, but they had to be very...
Total dance choreography. Oh my God, it was amazing.
Yeah, and then when the camera that just got handed off had to go to another room to get reloaded, mm-hmm. so that
get
we could
ready for the get next. Ready for the
next one, and then that camera had to go somewhere else. So we had to dance.
We had a tight team.
Oh, it was... We had 3 weeks of rehearsals. So it was funny, and we only had 5 days to shoot that long 85-minute shot and 3 days to shoot the other scenes. But those 5 days, we only had one take per day from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m., which was dusk to twilight. And we have, so it was, and on top of that, on top of just the camera stuff, the camera procedural chaos, the lighting was another thing. So because I wasn't able to get to a location to meter the light and to shape it the way I wanted per setup. We didn't have the luxury of stopping the camera each time and starting from scratch. My gaffer, Jordan Finley, and I, we had to set lighting for 4 or 5 different lighting scenarios based on ambient exteriors and interiors. So if the outside was rain or light rain or just overcast or overcast with some sun breaking through or some sun.
It's a West Coast day.
West Coast day. And things were changing. So we needed to make sure that, because every single one of those scenarios had different T-stops or different kind of balance and ratios of my lights inside and outside. So he had to be aware of what I wanted, and we had our chart of what we needed so that he would arrive 10 minutes before I arrived at a location, set it, make sure lights were on, and based on the light of what we had.
Light at the moment.
He would scoot out of there right before we got there. He would hop into another vehicle, get to the next location, and we were leapfrogging in that sense. And it was, so it was very, very all over the city. So, yeah. And it was insane. But it was a experience. And, you know, anyways, yeah.
So. Oh, that's great. And what's the title again?
So the title is a long title, The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open.
It's a beautiful title.
Yeah, it's a beautiful title, and it's based on an essay from an indigenous writer called, based on that title.
Oh, yeah, like, of course I want to see it.
Yeah,
it's probably going to get some attention.
It's definitely going to get some attention, and it's already getting attention. Yeah, I'm very, very excited for the world to see this film.
So when did you get your letters? Like, when did you apply for them?
I wish I knew the exact date, but I believe it was in... I believe I got my letters in 2012 or 14 or something like that. I think, no, I've had it for about 7 years, 7 or 8 years now. But I remember the moment I got it.
Ah.
Very, very specific moment.
What was going on?
I was sitting in this dingy Vietnamese restaurant with my friend Scooter Corkle, who's the director, and we were eating, like, it was just this crappy, rainy day outside at nighttime. And then I was just kind of, I think I remember being bummed that day. And I remember just sipping on my soup there, my noodle soup, eating some tendons. And all of a sudden, my phone, you know, dings, and I look at it, and I was like, oh, I got it. So I was very, very, and he was like, oh, that's amazing. So very, it was a very specific moment in my life, which I remember eating noodle soup.
It's very poetic, actually.
Yeah.
It had to bring joy into your life.
Yeah, no, it really did. And I'm a very proud member of the CSC. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm proud to be a part of it, and I'm proud to create a project that represents kind of the society.
Any tips and anecdotes for people starting out? Maybe a young cinematographer that's trying. If it's something that you wish you had, someone had maybe
said to me. Yeah. It's always a good question. Don't get caught up on technical. To really look at the emotion and the story. And even if, obviously, you need to have technical aspects of the job to make that happen, don't let technical advise story, because you can see right through it. And I don't feel that it's such a... In this day and age, technology is everywhere, and it's not enough to express emotion. So use technology only in the way to help drive the story.
So did you have any, like, learning moments in any projects where it was a big
mistake or
a mistake, or maybe something that just, it was a learning moment. Do you have any, like,
just thinking about one learning moment for me was in this last film, The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. It wasn't so much about learning technically or procedural or formats or lenses or anything like that. It was actually, for me, it was learning about equality. I learned about making sure that everyone has equal opportunity. So on this set, it was a very sensitive subject matter, and we had to treat it with respect. We had, in fact, we had mentees in every department. So I had a cinematography mentee and a grip lighting mentee, and we wanted to learn from them, and they wanted to learn from me. So it was a two-way avenue there. But it was also, again, the subject matter was so sensitive with violence against women and especially indigenous groups, that I wanted to make sure that I understood as much of the community as possible and the history There's a lot of history which I just still don't know about, but I wanted to make sure I respected that. So our film crew had to go through a workshop before the shoot to basically inform us how to approach this subject matter and to be respectful and to not... Like, there's a lot of film terms that are said, like, for example, powwow. People say that, and it's very disrespectful to certain groups, right? Well, actually, all groups, sorry. Powwow is very disrespectful and should not be used. And I remember you start to soak in these terms over the years, but you don't even realize where they're coming from. And I learned that, you know, I got to be careful what I'm absorbing, because it's not it's not about just these film terms that people just start saying. And I think it's very, very important to respect everyone. And then in this case, it was amazing because I think 65% of the crew was female. So that was amazing. And the vibe on set was so inspiring. So that's something I learned. It was something to how to make sure that from going forward is to make sure that there's this kind of community.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.